Peruvians have suffered the highest COVID-19 per capita death toll in all of Latin America, and the healthcare system is in a state of collapse. The country's economy contracted by more than 11% last year, wiping out millions of jobs and pushing what is expected to be more than 3 million people into abject poverty and hunger. At the same time, the criminal policies of the government and the employers have sparked strikes by miners, healthcare workers, public employees, and other sectors of the working class. The fear among the most conscious layers of the Peruvian bourgeoisie and transnational mining, finance, and other sectors invested in Peru is not of Castillo, but rather the radicalization and growing militancy among those who voted for him. Their concern is that a Castillo presidency, with its slogan of, quote, "no more poor in a rich country," unquote, could arouse expectations of change that will not be realized, leading to a social explosion. The bourgeoisie has already gone through the expense of Ollanta Humala, the former army officer who initiated his presidential campaign in 2006 as a quote-unquote 21st century socialist, only to pack his cabinet with reliable representatives of capitalist interests and carry out repression of workers' struggles. Kurt Borneo, an ex-deputy finance minister, who is now an Inter-American Development Bank executive in Washington and considered a likely presidential economic advisor to Castillo, told the Daily La Repubblica, quote, "When you look at Peruvian history, it is not unusual for someone to campaign from the left and govern from the right," unquote. Such sober assessments from representatives of the bourgeoisie, born of the experience of the so-called pink tide in Latin America, are entirely lacking among layers of the pseudo-left, both in the region and in North America and Europe, which have hailed the prospect of a quote-unquote socialist president in Peru. Among the crudest examples of this tendency is the Democratic Socialists of America, or DSA, which sent a delegation to Peru to observe the elections. It issued a statement declaring that, quote, "This election lights the way for other Latin American movements that seek revolutionary social change," unquote, and that the DSA itself wanted to emulate Castillo's example. This promotion of illusions that the way forward for the American Latin working class and oppressed masses lies in some kind of revival of the pink tide under the leadership of bourgeois parties like Peru Libre can only help pave the way to new defeats. It is entirely in line with the interests of the U.S. State Department in channeling the upsurge of the Latin American working class behind safe, quote-unquote, left bourgeois governments that can only serve as antechambers of a new wave of military dictatorships. The struggle in the defense of living standards and basic democratic rights can be advanced only on the basis of the political independence of the working class from all bourgeois parties, as well as their affiliated corporatist trade unions. A new revolutionary leadership must be built as sections of the International Committee of the Fourth International in Peru and throughout the region.
This has been Paul Fuller for the World Socialist Website.
The World Socialist Website is published by the International Committee of the Fourth International, the ICFI, the leadership of the World Socialist Movement, the Fourth International founded by Leon Trotsky in 1938. The World Socialist Website relies entirely on the donations of readers and listeners for financial support. To give to the WSWS or to set up a regular monthly contribution, go to wsws.org/donate. We urge our listeners to join the International Committee of the Fourth International and one of its affiliated political parties and take up the struggle for socialism.
Informativo Pacifica.
A continuación, Informativo Pacifica.
No te la pierdas.
Because we are the 99%.
Necesitamos priorizar lo que está pasando en la frontera y tenemos que priorizar por qué la gente va allí.
Vicepresidenta estadounidense Kamala Harris concluye su visita a México prometiendo mayores esfuerzos para frenar la migración del sur hacia su país.
Las exigencias siguen siendo el desarrollo del pliego nacional de emergencia.
Necesitamos priorizar lo que está pasando en la frontera y tenemos que priorizar por qué la gente va allí.
El pueblo colombiano cumple 46 días en un Kamala Harris destinado a obtener mayor justicia social. esfuerzos si para frenar la migración del sur hacia su país.
Las exigencias siguen siendo el desarrollo del pliego nacional de emergencia radicado por el Comité Nacional de Paro hace más de un año ante el gobierno de Duque.
El Congreso de los Mantecos de nombrar 43 días en un paro nacional destinado a obtener mayor justicia social.
La resistencia está trabajando duro para llegar a la ecuación de que el asalto a Jerusalén signifique una guerra regional.
El secretario general del grupo Hezbollah convoca a los musulmanes en el mundo a defender su templo en Jerusalén, magistrados del poder judicial, violando los protocolos habituales.
La resistencia está trabajando duro para llegar a la ecuación de que el asalto a Jerusalén signifique una guerra regional.
El secretario general del grupo Hezbollah convoca a los musulmanes
este programa con algunas notas del ámbito internacional preparadas por Norma Martínez.
A continuación del país, detalle otras noticias.
A punto de finalizar la contabilización de las actas de las elecciones presidenciales de Perú, el maestro rural Pedro Castillo del partido Perú Libre obtenía miércoles por la noche 50.22% de los votos.
A este programa con algunas notas del ámbito internacional preparadas por Norma Martínez.
La ventaja de Castillo era de 79.9% convocaron a protestar para anular las elecciones, informa la corresponsal de Telesur en Lima, Verónica Insausti.
Faltan apenas un porcentaje de actas por procesar provenientes de Cusco y el Braen, que aparentemente estarían sumando votos para Pedro Castillo. Las actas procedentes del extranjero, que inicialmente se pensaba con casi 1 millón de ciudadanos aptos para votar, iba a ser un porcentaje mayor, finalmente solo 390.000 compatriotas en el extranjero ejercieron su derecho al voto. De estos, un tercio fue para Pedro Castillo y dos tercios para Keiko Fujimori, cosa que no alcanzó.
And rumbling down the road, next it's the Bathrop Spears broadside show again. It's the 10th of June, 2021. We've got reports from Berkeley. Watsonville or the Pajaro River area, and a few other places too. Listen in and you'll find out.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So let's start off with this unexpected report from Monica Tone of the, I guess, the Pajaro River Homeless Union. I'm not quite sure what name is being given to the organizing that's being done right there along the Pajaro River, both east, west, north, and south. But Monica Tone is at the center of it. She's been there for, 8 or 9 years and has been struggling to maintain residence there in spite of flood and fury. So here's her report, which I received and just actually this afternoon, that was sent, I think, and made this morning.
Good morning, Santa Cruz. My name is Monica Tone. I'm reporting from Watsonville. I'm president of the Homeless Union out here on the Pajaro River, as well as Watsonville City. I'm just wanting to touch bases with everyone about a few things that I think that everyone needs to be mindful of. First of all, I hope that you guys are all having a good evening, and I am pre-recording this just so I can make sure that it gets out in case I'm not able to arrive on time. Right now it is about 7:13 a.m. and this is what I have to report from the Pajaro River homeless community as well as Watsonville period. So my general concern is this. The Pajaro River consists of Monterey County on one side, and the other side is Santa Cruz County, which is also part of Watsonville City and the outsprings of the county, which is like Sheriff, PD, and Monterey County Sheriffs. December, this is just a quick rundown, by the way. In December 2020, the coldest time of the year, COVID was full force. We had a shelter-in-place order, and along the Pajaro River homeless community, we were, I would say, I don't want to cry because it's still touching to this day. So around the 5th of December, the Monterey County Sheriff's Office came out to Pajaro River and decided that they wanted to, I guess, clean up, they said. They did no cleaning up. What they did was they bulldozed our shelters, left us with nothing, no blankets, no clothes, nothing at all. They took our shelters away. They expected us to go I don't know where to. At this time of the year, in December, all the shelters were full, and most of the shelters that were full also were on lockdown because of COVID outbreaks. Along the Pajaro River, I don't know anyone till this day who has had COVID or died of COVID on this river. I'm not saying we're immune, but I just don't know anybody. So during this time, this consisted of like 14 days of them coming out here to sweep. And I mean, bulldoze our, like, we had little cabins. Like, we were out of sight, out of mind. We are very clean down here. The only thing that we lack of, which this is my issue, we lack porta potties. We lack the cleaning stations like you guys have in Santa Cruz. And we, you know, we don't have, we have people that come out here and that, you know, they try to help with the food and stuff like that, which I'm so blessed because I'm thankful. Actually, not blessed. I'm beyond blessed to have people out here that can actually be part of a community that's willing to help and not take away. At this time of them coming down here, there's Hispanic people that don't speak no English at all, that didn't even know what's going on, so they can't even, I mean, even though a lot of Hispanic people, they don't know how to read Spanish either. So I'm kind of being their voice. Actually, I am being their voice and bringing this all to. So we have the situation that went down, and I've been out here on the river for now 9 years, and it was heartbreaking to have sheriff officers come down. These are people that are supposed to serve and protect. These are people that took an oath to protect, okay? Not an oath to pick and choose what they want to be done, okay? An oath to protect people, period. And around this time, they should have not have came down here trying to take any kind of shelters away. So they took our shelters away. It was a day before mine got taken down, the third day that they came down here. And when they took my place down, the next day it rained and it was so cold. I just remember, like, I put a tent back up, and I remember it raining on me, and I was humiliated. I would say I was physically, mentally, and emotionally just done. Just done. I've never had that experience where I just wanted to take my life and I didn't want to live no more. But anyways, I'm going to just bypass all that because I'm going to bring some the betterness to my life, okay? Anyways, so like I said, I'm pre-recording this, and excuse me for, you know, going around in circles if I am doing that. So we out here in Watsonville are being forgotten. Okay, there are known homeless encampments here in Watsonville, which is also Santa Cruz County. Santa Cruz County is focused on San Lorenzo. They need to stop focusing just on San Lorenzo homeless encampments, because there are a lot of homeless encampments. There's a lot of cities and little towns inside of the county of Santa Cruz. Okay, now I feel that if they're going to be, I want to use the word catering to the needs of us homeless people, that they needed to make sure that they're doing it all sites, you know, because nobody deserves to be humiliated, disrespected, or put down because of the lack of their housing. Okay, we might not have housing, but it doesn't mean that we're broke. Okay, even if we're broke, that doesn't mean that we don't have friends and family that love us. So we don't need to be discriminated against. We don't need to be disrespected at any means, downgraded. So I mean to bring this up because the city of Watsonville has, you know, they haven't really did too much sweeping on the Pajaro River, okay? But there are other sites that they're sweeping. And there's people out here that do have children. And no child should be outside. I mean, but it's not illegal to be homeless. Okay, as long as you're being a good parent and educating your child, sometimes children need to be, you know, go through the things with the families that they got to go through. That's just life experience. That's how you learn. That's the loyalties of family, which nobody really has these days. But that's another subject. So my whole point is, we don't have the bathrooms out here. Okay, we don't have a segregated place to go to. Watsonville, Monterey County and Santa Cruz County have got together with the Monterey County Water Works on a $400 million replacement of the reconstruction of the Pajaro River. Now this saddens me that they can go ahead and approve at this time in our life, with COVID going on, which is a killer, which I have other issues too that's beyond COVID, and we're going to talk about the roundup in a minute, for Santa Cruz County just to be focusing on, for Santa Cruz County to just be focusing on Santa Cruz downtown area, like, y'all need to get it together. Because let me tell you something. We are people, too, out here, and we deserve the same respect that they're getting out there in Santa Cruz. Not that they're showing any respect, because, I mean, I've been out there, and I've seen the what they call respect, okay? And I don't want none of it. But what I do want is for each homeless encampment that is known in Santa Cruz County to at least have water where they can wash their hands, toilets where they can use a bathroom, because they talk about sanitary stuff and all that other stuff that they want to talk about and all the COVID and da da da. Look, we need to have bathrooms out here. We need to have places to wash up out here. Now, I understand the Santa Cruz County, they say they have this all this money, but I don't know who it's going to go to, because I know a lot of nonprofit agencies out here that are doing for the homeless communities, and they don't have anything to do with the with Santa Cruz County donating any money. Let alone, I don't understand how these people can donate money when they don't even donate their time. They don't donate their time. How can you, sorry, Santa Cruz County, how can a person want to change something if the change is only going to be minimal? It's going to go back to the same thing, okay? Change doesn't last that long, okay? What we have to do is we have to figure out how to make a difference, okay? A difference in lives, because all the focus right now is on negative stuff, and until we can figure out how to make a difference, which difference means it's going to be seen, okay? It's going to make a change. The change is not going to just be for a little while, okay? The change is going to be indefinite.
And the only change that we can see here, at least in the front pages of the Santa Cruz Sentinel, or the Urinal, as I like to call the paper, is the headline, Homeless Camping Ordinance Adopted by writer Ryan Stewart. After five tries, city established ordinance to, quote, address homelessness. Actually, it is to drive homeless people out of sight and, if possible, out of town. What it essentially is a reimposition of the camping ban and including harshening its penalties, which had been moderated to some extent over the decades as a sort of a bone to activists and humanitarians in the community who found it absurd and cruel that people were being punished for falling asleep after 11 o'clock at night, which is what the old camping ordinance said. The new camping ordinance says if you essentially rest or fall asleep anywhere in an area where you can be accused of camping, that's a 24-hour crime now. And though they say it's not going to go into effect for a month, because that's how long new laws usually take to be posted and so forth, and that's the lag time they require. And they also require this ordinance, supposedly, and this was the sop that the city council threw out to essentially meet the requirements of the Martin versus Boise decision, which says you can't arrest someone if you haven't got a place for them to go in terms of sleeping. You can't arrest them for sleeping or camping. And, of course, Santa Cruz doesn't, in spite of all its lies to the courts and PR to the city council and to the community. It doesn't have that. It has very limited resources, more during the COVID, with a lot of funding rather badly spent generally, ineffectively, foolishly, if you will, spent, as previous so-called homeless funding has been done, all with sort of the alleged intention of ending homelessness in 10 years or three-year plans or different kinds of claims about housing people now, and we aren't going to have people sit around in tents. That's not good enough for them. That's why we're going to make camping illegal. That was the argument used back in the 90s by the so-called progressives on the city council, some of them. Anyway, the new ordinance makes the penalties harsher, although it pretends not to. It says, well, we're just going to give you a warning that you won't be able to sleep, and then if that doesn't work, we'll give you a ticket, and if that doesn't work, we'll arrest you and put you in jail up to a year. That's a misdemeanor. That is a harshening of the camping ordinance even now, sitting on the books. It hasn't gone into effect yet, so the old ordinance, I'm assuming, is still in force until the new one takes over. I'm not quite sure the technical specifics of that. Maybe there's no ordinance. But the only reason there is such a thing as a community campground right now is because the court ordered them to do it, and because the community rose up and said, if you're going to try to drive people out of San Lorenzo Park in winter, we're going to come up and we're going to stand in your way. And the first time they didn't stand in the way strongly enough, and the second time they did in December, and the police backed off, and the homeless union and attorney Anthony Prince stepped up and got an injunction with the help of the COVID crisis, which is now abating. So that whole basis for not removing people and for allowing them to shelter in place is going to probably be gone by June 29th when this case goes back to court, as I've repeatedly been saying. And that's the reason that HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, is now holding its meetings right above the benchlands next to the courthouse, with an invitation to the folks in the benchlands to come on up and join us if they wish. It's every Thursday at 11. It goes till 1. And public is welcome, of all stripes, believe it or not. And that's that gives us about 3 weeks until what I think is likely to be the dead end for the Benchlands campground. Although what the court will do is it will probably simply turn the management of the camp entirely over to the city and dissolve the injunction. And maybe it won't. I would be more pleased to see that. And maybe the city, you would say, has become more enlightened, or at least realized it's going to be ridiculous if they try to disperse this campground, because it will flow everywhere through the city up into the fire-prone Poganip. That is just, it's a bad idea. But an intention of the city authorities to pander to the fears and anti-homeless hostilities of some segments in the community, and in both the residential community, the business community, and the seaside community, you can't really underestimate this desire to lie down and if you will, spread your legs or show your butt. It's a long-standing weakness or tendency that the city government has, perhaps largely because funding for the election campaigns comes from those places, at least a significant portion of it. That's the reason we don't have any real rent control in Santa Cruz, or any real studies that show how much profit the landlords actually make and what they do, as they constantly claim, we're just mom and pop and we're poor people, and some of them are. But there's no been real study of how much profit is made, how much the costs of being a landlord are. I've talked about this with a few landlords. I haven't really gotten into it. I may be having a conversation with Darius Marcelin, who's a notorious landlord in some quarters. Some call him a slumlord. In an upcoming show, he has repeatedly promised to expose all his costs so that we can see just how much profit he makes off, let's say, a typical property that he rents to people, and how much rent he charges. I'm hoping that we can get that kind of information. Clearly, I think he's riding around the country at the moment, but may be able to reach him in time for the Sunday show. We'll see. Anyway, what should be said about the camping ban that has been put into place? I think they're calling it the CSSO, the Camping Standards and Services Ordinance, is that it doesn't really provide any specific services. And the only standards it provides are homeless begone once we make some kind of token shelter and token storage available. Now, I'm sure that those who have written this ordinance, including the Sunny City Council majority, which passed it 5-2, would tell you, there's 150 spaces for people. But considering that there are over 1,000 homeless people, we have estimates between 1,000 and 2,000 homeless people outside or in temporary shelters that aren't necessarily continuously funded or available, you have a pretty ridiculous claim as far as there being shelter for the average homeless person or storage for the average homeless person. It also, of course, it's billed as an attack on large encampments, which is somehow the big menace, when in fact the community in large encampments, even though there is drug use, you know, and even though it can be noisy and loud and a little unwieldy, it can be a real step forward from isolated circumstances, far from social services, off into fire-prone areas, and without the kind of internal monitoring that happens when communities begin to develop, as may well be happening in the benchlands. Now, there are various meetings coming up for people who are interested in this. What I'm interested in knowing is how these folks in the benchlands are going to be able to, and how the community is going to be able to be supportive if and when, and I'm afraid it's sooner rather than later, the city moves to disperse the benchlands and tell you, we've got a nice gravel yard for you up at 1220 River Street for 60 tents, and then we've got a nice waiting list. So all you got to do is sort of hide out for a while and wait it out, and you'll get in there. And besides, you'll be getting some government grant money somewhere along the road, and things have improved. And so, and I mean, we're doing the best we can. And it's not perfect. And the perfect is the enemy of the good and that sort of thing, and these various cliches that come rolling at you. So what's really intended here, as I said before, is an attempt by the city council to essentially pass and put into law Chief Mills' camping ban. It's essentially a ban that is supposed to work around the Martin versus Boise decision that says you don't arrest them unless you can find some place for people to sleep, by claiming, well, if we create some places to sleep, we can always say we have places to sleep. And, of course, there's also the issue, which is brought up in this article, about the lawsuit that may be forthcoming as far as the Coastal Commission goes. The Coastal Commission requires there be coastal access in the coastal zone, which includes about a half mile in from the ocean, and so a significant chunk of Santa Cruz. And in that area, the idea that you suddenly can ban everybody at night from sleeping outside whose residences are outside, without providing really places for them to go other than a few, is, well, they couldn't sell it for RVs when they tried to pass a nighttime RV ban, even for just a part of the daytime. But I guess the theory being, if we make it really hard for RVs to park at night in the city, then they'll be gone during the day too, unless they are well-to-do folks who have the resources to do differently. But in fact, while the local coastal commission said, "Oh, that's just fine. We got no problem with that," the bigger coastal commission, the state coastal commission, said, when it was presented with an appeal that some of us filed, they said, "You got to prove to us that there's a real crime problem in allowing people in RVs putting up parking restrictions that essentially ban people from RVs all over the place." Although that's still what the city is doing, and it hasn't been challenged by the local coastal commission, although it is in violation of the state coastal commission's apparent ruling of about 5 years ago. And this homeless ordinance, I should say, this anti-homeless ordinance, has a similar problem as far as its supporters go, which is that it does not really, A, lacks places for people to go, and B, it lacks evidence that there's any justification for regarding these homeless folks as a suspect criminal group, which, of course, is the whole rationale behind these ordinances, behind this particular ordinance. So, before I go any further, let me give you a little music to steady yourself by.
Never say a stupid thing, wrong place, wrong crowd. To take it back, make it go away. Now dig a little deeper beneath the scab of shame. Something you pray you've never done, something you dare not make. From the winding web you've spun, to only be remembered for the worst you've ever done. Maybe you betrayed a friend, perhaps you hurt a child, or won some heart and broke it just to watch that heart go wild. You might have done it on a whim. You might have
That was The Worst You've Ever Done by Charlie King and Karen Brandow from their album Puppet Town, of which we will hear a few more soon. I was in a meeting today with a couple of newcomers to the Huff scene. One of them was Joy, who had been a member, and I guess is a member, of the Democratic Socialists of America here, a local group that sometimes I'm skeptical of, other times I'm grateful for the support they provided for folks outside. Here's an article that is interesting to me because it concerns a real estate tax being upheld in San Francisco, and that seems to be the objectives of one of the objectives of the Democratic Socialists here in Santa Cruz. This is an article in the Chronicle by Bob Agelko, and it's sometime in the last, I guess it's May 27th or thereabouts. The state Supreme Court allowed San Francisco on Wednesday to keep collecting its property transfer tax, an assessment on real estate transactions that charges higher rates to owners who sell more expensive properties. The court unanimously denied review of an appeal by a former hotel owner who said the tax discriminated against wealthy property owners. The transfer tax approved by San Francisco voters charges sellers $2.50 for each $500 of the sale price for properties worth up to $250,000, but increases rates for more expensive sales. Sellers of properties worth more than $25 million are charged $15 for every $500 of the price rather than $2.50. City officials said the tax raised $364 million in 2018-2019. That amount is expected to increase by $186 million because of the voters' approval last November of Proposition I, which raised levies on properties worth $10 million or more. Similar taxes are in effect in Oakland, Berkeley, San Jose, and Richmond. And there's more details, but of course, I would like to see such a tax here. The sooner the better. And when businessman Donald Trump, that's his pre-presidential years, when Donald Trump challenged a New York State real estate transfer tax that exempted some lower-priced transactions in 1985, a state court ruled against him and said administrative convenience and expense in the collection or measurement of a tax are alone a sufficient justification for the difference between the treatment of small incomes or small taxpayers. Not quite sure I totally understand that. But the case is up in San Francisco most recently, Ashford Hospitality Advisors versus San Francisco. And let's turn now to Berkeley, where some folks are, well, living in tents in People's Park, which is in a sort of a block area, most of a block, right in back of between Telegraph and Bowditch Streets, Haste and Dwight Way. I went up there the other day picking up Street Spirit newspapers, and we have the new June issue for those interested. And if you don't have occasion to run into me or get to a Huff meeting, which is where these are usually available, you can try Food Not Bombs, where I usually leave some off. And it's something people can sell if they're poor and homeless or on that edge. It doesn't make you much. You can sell them for $2 each, but, you know, it's something. There's also a way to get them online if you want to read The Street Spirit. I think it's thestreetspirit.org, and you can read some of the latest articles. They've gotten a little soft because I think they're taking money from Berkeley City, which is too bad. It tends to make them disinclined to be critical of Berkeley politicians' crap, which you hear, for example, Carol Denny going into if you're a regular listener. In any case, I went up to Berkeley on, I guess it was last Sunday, and saw a large structure in the middle of People's Park called the People's Kitchen. And curious and also interested in kind of hearing what was going on up there, I set out with an audio recorder in hand, and this is what I came back with. Park. York, and it's about 2:20 on June 7th. I'm talking with
Elizabeth Gill.
And you are a member of the
People's Park Committee.
And you've just finished kitchen swabbing.
Yeah, definitely. Cleaning out the kitchen. It's made of pallets. It's painted by some of the artists in the park. Some of the People's Park Committee people done a great job of painting it. It's not totally finished yet, but yeah, we feed people here.
How big is that? I can see the front of the kitchen here.
Well, you're welcome to come inside.
Okay, why don't we just describe it? Well, we can walk up there.
Okay, we've got three barbecues. This is our chef here, Chef Nick.
Chef Nick.
Yes, and so we get people coming in from our community donating food. There's another woman in here named Christina also helping me clean today and doing a great job, I might add, which, you know, you can meet her also.
How many people do you serve, or does the kitchen serve daily, or is it?
And is hundreds, it, probably.
Now, is it a kitchen that a few people run, or is it run, people could come in and use the facilities? How does that work?
Mostly, Chef Nick here will feed the people. He'll make up. He's got three barbecues here. We'll cook something up. He will. I'm actually responsible for the water tank. So this water tank here came from the free clinic and cooperation or with another woman called Green Mary. So these are all volunteers, and this particular tank is huge. As you can see, all the tents.
Pretty big.
Yeah, and
how many tents would you say you've got here?
Oh, gosh, I don't know.
Now, is it my imagination, or are there less than there were a month ago?
Not necessarily,
okay.
Because people come and go. It's an ebb and flow here. So this particular tank I want to tell you is I live in West Berkeley. I live further away. And so there's another community of the RV dwellers. And I had talked to the women who were maintaining this tank, similar tank down there in West Berkeley. And that's how I came upon them and said, we need one in People's Park. And actually, they came through. It was awesome.
How long have you had the water here?
I would say a couple months, at least, yeah.
Because, yeah, I hadn't seen it before I was here.
Yeah.
4 months ago.
It's awesome. Look how much we use just cleaning the kitchen. Here, come on. So,
just step over. It's always hard to get water out.
So we're entering the kitchen.
It's really crucial to have water.
Kitchen corral. That's the kitchen guard dog.
Yeah, that's the guard dog.
Maybe he's greeting us.
Yeah. So here's some of the barbecues. Here's the storage. In here. We're cleaning out in here. We've got a lot of canned foods, obviously.
Some veggies, a lot of flies.
Yeah, well, we're doing our
beans.
We are going to get in solar panels.
Dig it.
And there's going to be a refrigerator coming in very shortly.
And a bunch of police to knock everything down, or
what's this?
A bunch of police to knock
everything down.
I would hope not. I'm just wondering what's the status? Are you getting? Is the mayor giving you comforting words, or ignoring you, or snarling at you, or
ignoring us?
That's probably for the best.
At this point, yeah. And this is Christina here.
Hello,
Robert, Christina.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah. And so, this is the guard dog. He's pretty mellow, actually.
What is the name of this dog?
Rahula.
Hey,
this is
Rahula.
Chef Nick's dog.
Oh, okay.
The one on the other side.
Hi, Rahula.
Rahula.
It's okay.
And here's Rahula.
You're
fine. So here's Christina, and here we have enough. The canned goods. You can step in there.
Okay.
And an oven. Well, she's actually...
Christina, a long-time worker in the kitchen? Or?
No, I've just been doing this for a few months now.
Huh.
Yeah.
Are you in a tent? Or
no, I have a home. I just come every once in a while and bring some food.
You're a volunteer.
I'm just a volunteer, yeah.
Just a volunteer.
Just
a volunteer. In other words, you keep the thing going, is what you're saying, right? So what's the most needed food store here, you would say?
What do they need the most? I know Nick always wants meat because he likes to barbecue in the evenings. That's very popular. What else do you think is most
needed?
Snacks.
Need? They snacks. Like a lot of snacks.
Snacks. I usually bake some stuff, and that usually goes pretty fast. Some cookies and brownies
coffee,
and stuff.
Coffee, of course,
oh,
in the morning.
Coffee. Yes, I brought coffee. That is very popular, and they love creamer. The flavored creamers are really popular.
Not many vegans here?
I've had a few, but not a ton.
I'm vegetarian. So I can speak for myself
here. Yeah, there's a few, and I usually try to bring a few vegan things, but it's surprisingly, a lot of people want meat also, I've noticed.
Yeah. So she brought PB&J today.
Yes, I usually try to bring some vegan options. And I usually try to make a vegan granola bar also.
Do you get a lot of people coming from outside the park to eat?
Sometimes. Yeah. Not necessarily.
Is there regular meal times or is just... whenever people are hungry.
I think Nick tries to do a dinner, but otherwise people just kind of come up and say they're hungry, and I give them, if I have food or make sandwiches, I give them sandwiches.
Nick is usually in the kitchen.
Yeah.
Now, so Nick lives here.
Right. He's on a motorhome, an RV dweller.
And no hassles for the RV dwellers by police recently?
I wouldn't say that, but, keep your fingers crossed.
Right. But have they gone after any of the main activists?
We're still in the pandemic, so that's... protecting a lot of people.
Until the governor decides it's an emergency, but it's not an emergency.
I'm with you on that.
Yeah, right.
Totally with you.
So I was asking, and remind me of your name again.
Christina.
And you are?
Elizabeth.
Elizabeth. That shouldn't be that hard to remember.
No, it shouldn't. And we're running propane on a lot of the barbecues and whatnot. But we'll soon get, hopefully, fingers crossed, we're having a technician coming with the solar panels from the free clinic, and that is a guy named Nick G.
As distinguished from Chef Nick.
No, our chef is Nick A.
That's different. He's A1, the other one's just
G. Nick G.
Gotcha.
Yeah, they're awesome people here. Thank you.
Looks like Rahula has retreated or going to rest.
Well, I petted
That's
for
right.
a while. Yeah.
How's the food? How's the food here?
So we're just getting through finishing up cleaning the kitchen.
Santa Cruz.
You're not
telling
me
to get a place to
study. Pardon me?
You're not telling me to get a place to study.
Don't know how.
Social Security.
Wow. Yeah.
So we've got students on this side of the park, a lot of UC Berkeley students here,
right.
And then we've got a lot of homeless people here, or unhoused,
right.
However we want to describe people, and then we do have RV dwellers, but very few.
Are they mostly down in...
Right. They're mostly down there because it's an enclave at Ace and Harrison. In Berkeley, in West Berkeley, exactly.
So you're looking for a place to stay, right? How long have you been looking for that place? Do you mind if I record you for free radio?
Yeah.
Is that okay or not? Okay. Saying, Elizabeth, you had some Facebook awareness of one of our Santa Cruz folks.
Absolutely. Julie.
You want to say hello to her?
Hi, Julie.
She might listen to this. I have no idea.
You're awesome. Hello, I appreciate everything. She posts up almost every single day about RV dwellers all throughout the United States, different states, Oregon, Washington, Texas, you name it, and a very informative post.
Sometimes a little dated. I get a little confused sometimes. There's a court case. Oh, but wait, it was in 2016. But,
so you have an injunction.
We do. It's until June 29th.
Oh, coming up.
And then they get a status hearing to figure out what's going on.
I see.
And they say, get out, or we're turning it over to the city because they care so much about you.
Mm. Well, our kitchen's been kind of under the radar for the time being.
Although it's very visible.
It definitely is visible.
Police visit here much?
Not really. Not unless they're called in.
And has there been, you say there's a lot of turnover among the population. Any long-time folks who stay? This guy we just talked to, who's looking for a place to stay, was saying he's walking away there now.
Oh, yeah.
He's been here a year.
Okay.
And
there are long-term people here, definitely. They're on this section here, the opposite section. Yeah, I'm not so sure they're there right now.
That's the Bowditch and Dwight Way section.
Right. Uh-huh. Up in the upper right-hand corner of the park.
It just looks to me like some tents have disappeared. I mean, have gone from, let's say, 2 or 3 months ago.
Yeah.
And is that, if that's true, I'm wondering, is that because people are finding housing, they're getting tired of being here?
Oh, I doubt they're finding housing. Right. I seriously doubt. But they might be finding a temporary room. But as far as housing goes, I don't think so. But I'm opinionated anyways. But
I don't allow opinions. I'm sorry.
There has been some camps that were cleared out down near the freeway from the Caltrans. big lawsuit against Caltrans.
I remember it just got settled. About a year ago, I think.
Right, exactly. So
OSHA Newman.
Right, OSHA Newman. And so we're not sure whether or not people are going to gravitate here, if there's going to be more pressure on them.
Other parks also witnessing the arrival of tents, or just this park?
Good question. I am not so sure, because I'm pretty much here as People's Park Committee member and the RV encampment. I can only do so much.
What do you hear about Oakland encampments? Any connection back and forth between these camps?
Yeah, there
camps?
Are people who are on the committee that are not here right now, but they actually have gone to West Oakland. Yeah, back and forth.
Maybe what I could do, Elizabeth, is get your info and also give you, I'll put you on the Huff email list if you
Great.
Want. And I can call you by phone, maybe
Sure.
get updates,
Sure.
more information. You can call me if you want
Absolutely.
Questions. I don't know if Julie has a phone number she's given out, but I will certainly...
Well, I can message her. I've already asked her a few Okay. things. She's gotten back to me, and that was great.
Take it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a nice day. People are mellow. As I said, it seems quieter. I'm always...
We just got through with the Zoom meeting of People's Park Committee.
And what was the outcome of that? Anything
in the... We'd love to ask Chef Nick. Yeah. We're right now finishing up the kitchen.
Well, listen, I'll let you get back to work.
Thank you.
Anything else you want to add or say to folks down in the Santa Cruz area or whoever listens to this?
Keep on trucking. I don't know what else to tell you, because it's been a tough time with the pandemic. We don't know what's happening. Kind of like nebulous, all of this.
Go one way or the other.
As far as what the governor's doing, we're not really sure.
And what the CDC says the governor can do without getting
right.
chastised for ending shelter in place.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Fair enough. And we've been talking with...
Elizabeth Gill.
Thanks, Elizabeth.
No worries.
How can people get in touch with the People's Park Committee if they want to learn more information about it?
Chef Nick.
And if they're in Santa Cruz, how can they get in touch? By email, phone,
right.
telegram?
There's People's Park Committee on Facebook. But also, if there's two committee members right now, right there. So just head on over.
And buttonhole them, huh? Okay. Fair enough. Thank you, Elizabeth.
You're welcome. Pleasure to meet you.
Well,
heard about you for years. That's right.
I've heard about me for years, too, but
I think you've
not
been
to
our city council, haven't you?
I have.
Many years ago.
On occasion, I grunted at them, you know.
Right, I remember. I totally remember.
Right now, you're not having city council meetings. You're having these pseudo city council meetings, right?
Yeah.
So are we. I'm so tired of the Zoom.
So am I.
This is not good. Well, this is wonderful.
Love will find a way.
Yep.
And food, apparently, too.
Yes. Thank you.
Thanks, Elizabeth.
You're welcome.
With?
Nick.
And Nick, you are known as Chef Nick?
Chef Nick. By
Chef
some.
Nick A.
Chef Nick A, or Yoga Man, some people call me, or just Nick, you know, depending on what your inclination is.
And you've lived here for a while.
I've been in Berkeley for around 15 years, off and on. Even went to UC Berkeley, graduated in 2017.
No problem. And your tent arose here when?
This kitchen arose March 7th. I had a friend that has been kind of hustling me to build a kitchen here for a minute. I had built a kitchen back in Berkeley in Occupy that was at Civic Center Park in 2011. I've built a lot of different kitchens, and like the Rainbow. I worked with Shut Up and Eat It in Arizona. And I even had a bus on the side of this park back in like 2014 that I served food out of. So I've just regularly done this. So my friend convinced me, and because of the COVID restrictions and the fact that university was letting all these tents up, we made the gamble that we'd be able to build a structure and most likely they wouldn't tear it down immediately. Though we knew they were going to tear it down eventually. That just was...
For 3 months it's been up.
It has been up for 3 months. More recently, the university comes to clean the encampment on Tuesdays, and the director of facilities, Felix, comes to harass me, and he likes to tell me it's going to tear it down and I should save everything I want. It's kind of a ritual of his every Tuesday.
He gives you a date that they never
come. No, it's all ambiguous. He can't even distinguish what makes this structure more severe than a 10. I brought up the point that in the eyes of the law and the university, you know, a tent is just as much a structure as a wooden structure is. The only difference is I happen to be feeding people out of my structure and people aren't in a tent. And so I tried to convince them that if, you know, you're going to target my structure and no one else's when they are, you know, equally seen in the eyes of the law, then I'm going to file an injunction, you know, because that's discrimination right there.
Do you have legal help to do that, or do you have the expertise to do that?
Is that
an idle threat?
It's not an idle threat. In fact, I actually almost filed an injunction against UC Berkeley for a public records request. The police department refused to give me a name. I tried to get it, and, you know, they almost reflexively don't give out any information and require you to get an injunction from...
For your own safety. I'm sorry, officer safety.
Well, no, it's a bunch of bullshit. You know, it frees them of the liability in case I get the name and I, you know, do something to the individual. By making a judge, you know, file injunction and making a judge release the name, it kind of, you know, clears them of that liability. But point being, I have filed injunctions before. I was going to law school. I took my LSAT. I decided against it. And I graduated UC Berkeley as an honor.
You abandoned a shyster career.
I did, yeah. Well, I've never really met a happy lawyer. I've met conceited lawyers and angry lawyers and...
Arrogant lawyers.
I mean, the whole gamut.
Slimy lawyers.
I mean, there are good people out there. Look at OSHA at the East Bay Community Law Center.
Overburdened lawyers?
Overburdened, you know, and then not compensated well enough to make the sacrifice worth it for them. You know, a lot of times nonprofit law or the law that really is helping those in this community or helping those that are less fortunate doesn't pay well. And then you have to pay back those loans, and then you're working extreme hours. I could, perfect example, the Eviction Defense Center in Oakland, they helped me when I was getting evicted from my house. They do completely free work. They don't charge anyone anything. If you're of a certain...
Name of the group again.
Eviction Defense Center. You could just tell how much they worked. And they were really good people, but eventually it taxes you. You know, I had to take 2 days from the kitchen recently because I'm really the only one kind of managing it and cleaning it and doing all that. And eventually, no matter how good heart you have, how much you believe in altruism, you know...
Your muscles start getting tired.
The body will fail, you know, and the mind will also fail because there's only so much you can do. Yeah, I don't know why I got on that tangent, though.
It's quite relevant tangent. Let me ask you, I noticed when I was here in March, I don't think the People's Kitchen was up at that point, but there seemed to be more tents. Is that my imagination?
No, you are correct. A lot of encampments more recently have been getting demolished because COVID supposedly is over now, or is almost over.
How do they demolish them? What do they do?
Well, luckily, outside of this space, a lot of the communities get warning. So, for instance, there was an encampment in Emeryville that a bunch of people and I helped kind of move their stuff. They took it to court, and the judge ordered part of the encampment moved. All of that was given with clear timelines, with a clear framework moving forward, so that, you know, I was able to come with a bunch of friends, and we were able to move these people's stuff and get them a new tents and, you know, salvage what we could.
Is Emeryville protected by an injunction right now?
Well, part of it is, but another part is there's a certain kind of way in which I think municipalities are dealing with these encampments, and that's giving them time. You know, they realize it's not humane to just come in at 6 in the morning and uproot someone who has nowhere else to go. And so the city of Berkeley...
They give you 3 days and then uproot you to where you have no place to go.
Yeah, those 3 days are critical, though, and I'm not saying that's good. Right. You know, it's the lesser of two evils. I prefer neither, you know, but it's what we have to work with, and that's kind of a benefit. But to the point of the increased tents, that's one of the contributors to that, is that a lot of these encampments are dissolving, and because of that, we're getting an influx of new people.
So you think there actually is an increase in the number of tents here?
Oh, absolutely, and an increase of new community members. I see them all the time. And some of them come and go. Some of them stay. I mean, it really depends on the person and how they integrate into the community. But but there definitely there's always been an increase every year in Berkeley. I've been here since 2008. You know, you see it how there's like another homeless person that ends up staying, and then another homeless person that stays, and another.
And we'll hear another, well, another 40 minutes of this interview with Chef Nick and Elizabeth, and maybe a few others. I think they were the principal speakers, but we will take a musical pause.
Smiling face, outstretched hand, through disputes, small and grand, we will lay down our guns. We are one. In the rain, through the war, we have shared pain before. In our grief, when it's done, we are one. We are one. Where the earth touches sky, we are born. We all die. Where the clear waters run, we are one. We are one. Where the light touches land, over sea, over sand, when each day has begun, we are one. When the rock wears away and the tide rolls and sways, by the moon, by the sun, we are one. We are one. Where the earth touches sky, we are born, we all die. Where the clear waters run, we are one. We are one. In the soft of the night, we will learn not to fight. In our hearts, in the drum, we are one. In the birth of a child, through the fears and the miles, in our daughters and our sons, we are one. We are one. En las hijas y los hijos, somos uno. Somos uno.
And that was another from Puppet Town by Charlie King and Karen Brandow, We Are One. And now back to People's Park in Berkeley.
Some of them stay. I mean, it really depends on the person and how they integrate into the community. But there's always been an increase. Every year in Berkeley, I've been here since 2008, you know, you see it, how there's like another homeless person that ends up staying, and then another homeless person that stays, and another home, and and they never get housing, and so they just, you know, remain part of the kind of street community, as it were. And it's only ever been increasing.
What do you notice as far as evictions go in the last year? Is that increasing in spite of the so-called moratorium?
Well, no. I think a lot of people are protected, but it's about to happen. One of the failures of this eviction moratorium is that there was no, rent washed away, essentially. Everyone still owes a portion of rent. One of the reasons I had to deal with eviction myself, I had like rats and horrible habitability issues, and I wasn't paying rent for a year. And then I tried to convince my landlord, okay, let's work with it. He didn't talk to me. And I just let it be for about 3 or 4 months. And then he gave me a 3-day pay or quit with those 4 months of a 3-bedroom house that I was living in by myself. It totaled to about $10,000. And so
robbed a bank.
I sued him instead and robbed his bank and got $25,000 from him to leave. So
how long ago was this?
That was about a year or two ago. It was right after I graduated Cal. About three years ago. Right after I graduated Cal, and I wasn't sure what I was going to do, and I wasn't going to law school anymore, and I couldn't rely on fellowships and grants. And so my my revenue avenues were kind of...
Does this make you a hero, a villain, or simply a legendary figure?
It depends on who you ask, honestly. I'm probably all three, depending on the person. I've had it, you know, this is why Berkeley is my home. You know, I was a foster kid. I spent most of my adolescence homeless, you know, hitchhiking around. And, you know, this is the first, when I came here, there was like a huge drum circle in People's Park. Someone gave me a little bit of acid, and I ended up wandering up the hill with a bunch of hippies. And that was like literally my first day in Berkeley. This town kind of stole my heart and it's made me feel like such a part of the community. I walk everywhere with my dog and everyone says hi to me.
Your dog?
Rahula.
That's right. I met your dog.
You did.
Your dog barked at me.
Yes, he barks at many people. The Beast of Berkeley, 110-pound wolf hybrid. I've had him for 10 years. I even got him at Berkeley during the Occupy when I was running the kitchen. The gentleman that had him before got arrested and extradited to Alabama for some reason. And the dog was just kind of abandoned at the Occupy. And so I used my clout as the, you know, person that fed people to take the dog. And I went up to a weed farm and stayed there for a year and just trained him and learned all his kind of, you know, unique personalities and
Dog whispering.
Well, he's a wolf hybrid, and he's 110, so I had to whisper something to be able... Yeah, 110 pounds. He's a big boy.
I think 110, not 110 years old.
No, he's 10 years old, though. I've had him for 10 years. And so he's getting older, as we all are.
Are there dogs here on the encampment?
No, in fact. That's actually a surprise, because we used to have a lot of dogs in this park, almost to a problematic level, because a lot of them would be off-leash, and then, you know, you'd have unneutered dogs getting into fights. But I believe right now we only have two other dogs. One's name is Watson, and the other's name is Regal. I believe Watson is some type of mixed medium-sized dog, and Regal's just like a Chihuahua.
How do you deal with, or how does the camp deal with, or the population here deal with disputes rather than calling police? Or do they call police?
Well, no, police is still frowned upon. You know, if you call the police in this park, you're going to be dealing with a culture that will have an animus towards you from that point forward. You know, it's problematic. I feel personally that this is kind of endemic of a lot of the systematic injustices of our society, and so necessarily that comes with certain traumas that aren't necessarily dealt with that then manifest perhaps in violent ways. You know, it can get ugly dealing with disputes here. Luckily, like my own personal context, I know so many people here. I've been here forever. You know, I've cooked food for everyone. I have a really large network.
You have a cachet.
Yeah, you know, I have people that support me. And so that kind of helps mitigate some of my conflicts, because people know if they're going to have a problem with me, then by necessity they're going to have a problem with a bunch of other people. and they don't want that. I mean, I went to Willard Shower the other day, and someone said, hey, you're friends with security, just out of the blue. I'm like, well, you know, that's not an incorrect observation. I'm, you know, very, I would call the security of this park my family. I've known them for over a decade, you know.
Security of the park, you mean?
You know, the people that you would not want to cross. You know, the people that
guys with guns and badges.
No, not guys with guns and badges, but unfortunately, you know, there are guns in the park. You know, I'm not going to sugarcoat that. Go ahead.
A lot of violence, or?
It's hit or miss. You know, again, I think a lot of the violence stems from, you know, systematic problems that or issues that you aren't necessarily even addressed by society in a good way. You think of mental health, for instance. I had a woman going through a psychosis just barge into the kitchen, completely out of her mind, and throwing things everywhere. And because she was a woman, and you know those archetypal standards, I was kind of a little hesitant to put my hands on her and kind of
back off from the beans.
Yeah, but yeah, that was pretty much my go-to. Honestly, I'm like, what are
Did you
doing?
Call the women troops?
Luckily, I got other people there that dealt with it for me, elders, actually.
Elder men.
But they were old enough that I don't think people would have thought negatively about it.
How did she respond?
Not well. I mean, I think she punched one. She got incredibly violent. You know, it was causing a lot of trouble. She was obviously going through some type of, if I may say, a drug-induced psychosis. And so in that kind of moment, you know, it's probably going to manifest in disruptive ways. The police ended up getting called because I think someone brought out a taser because she was becoming completely unresponsive to our requests. And I think there was a social worker, and the social worker called the police. The police came here, and they gave her a 7-day exclusion and just kind of pushed her away, which again shows you kind of the systemic problems of our society, because that person should not have been pushed away. That person should have been brought somewhere where they're embraced in some type of apparatus that could give them help.
You can do it if you feel that way.
If you feel that way, well, that's why Berkeley's working on a new unit, you know, that's separate from the police.
Giving most of its money to the police.
Because as the city manager said, there is no kind of structure right now of this alternative, you know, group or method is going, how it's going to function. So you can't give money to something that doesn't exist yet. I don't know
if I believe that or not.
Hey! Well, you know, I don't
it's
like...
It's coming from the city manager.
I know.
Equally bad source.
It is a very bad...
I don't know the city manager.
Oh, she's a horrible woman. She tried to evict the Here There encampment. We had to file an injunction on her. She did that during, I think it was a holiday. It was about a year or two ago. I don't like the city manager, but, you know, I would like people's criticism to be based in reality. The city, as an organization and a municipality, is not going to throw money at something that has no budget, for instance. You know, because how do you even throw money at something that you don't know how much it's going to cost? But we're moving forward, and it has to move forward. It's part of our, new laws. So I'm hopeful. And in that way, you know, these kind of systemic issues that cause the violence, which was my original point, like why we see a lot of violence here is because we see
What does a lot of violence mean? Let's say per week, how many instances of what you call an assault happen that...
Five or six. Almost daily, there's some type of kerfuffle that's usually instigated by someone that is not, and a lot of times it doesn't go to the point of getting physical. Sometimes it will just be, for instance, someone run out of the park with a bat. And they actually leave the park, or people.
Assault rather than battery.
Yes, it's not good. I wouldn't condone it. But again, you know, we were having this discussion earlier. A lot of the violence here is contextual, and if you understand the context of how it arose, you wouldn't necessarily agree with it, but you could understand it.
Where it came from.
Exactly, and then also understand how society needs to change so that we don't have to be put in situations where we need to be violent. You know, allow that universal income and universal housing so people don't have desperation, so they don't do things that they kind of have to
How
in order to survive.
How has the park changed over the period of time you've been here?
Woo! It's changed quite a bit.
I'm thinking mostly during COVID. Let's say between March of last year.
It's changed even before COVID, unfortunately. I gave the story of when I came, you know, the hippie drum circle and the, you know, getting fed acid and all that. That kind of culture has shifted a little bit. And there's certain drug uses in the park that have become more open in a shocking way. You know, I see people using drugs in groups that I would have never seen use those drugs openly in groups before.
Drugs and heroin and
methamphetamine. You know, like I saw a group the other day just all with their own bubbles, you know, talking and having a normative discussion together, but they were all smoking meth individually with their own pipes. And, like, the needles, there's a lot more needles in this park. We're picking up needles every day. And part of that, I think, and I really hate to say this, but has to do with the fact that UC Berkeley discontinued their dedicated police force here. Back in the day, we used to have, I'll call them drive-bys, but they were on bicycles. You know, bicycle cops drive by the park at least four times a day. You know, people are on their toes. You know, they were like, oh, should I have this out? Should I not? You know, and it acted as a deterrence that moderated certain forces in this park. The university, I think back in 2011, and as a strategy to honestly get rid of this park, discontinued that completely so that there was zero police presence in this park. In turn, that kind of enabled certain behaviors that otherwise would have been either hidden or less open. Pointing back, the other day I was drinking with some friends, and I just had the can right next to me. And my friend, who also goes back in Berkeley a long time, just commented on it. And we were kind of laughing. Like back in the day, we'd get a ticket.
Open container.
We all know it. But like that, we could just have it so out shows you the ubiquity of the situation.
So, what about in this last year? Has there been much of a change in how
the
culture here?
The encampment changed the dynamics of the park extremely. You know, it became a homeless encampment. And while I would argue
what
that...
What was it before?
Well, it was just a... Touche. Well put question. Was a homeless encampment, honestly, and that's
were people camped here before the encampment?
Well, they were
before the COVID.
Well, I used to actually tie hammocks up into the trees and sleep in the trees before I got my dog. And
what year was it?
Well, that was like 2009, 2008, 2010, because I got my dog in 2011.
But police would still give trespass tickets for people being here after 10, right?
Yes, but, you know, then there is a jurisdictional issue here. This is UCPD jurisdiction. That, on the corner, that's next to the church and the Vedanta Center, that's BPD jurisdiction. So a lot of times what people would do was they'd be set up a tent on BPD jurisdiction, or they'd have it on UCPD and then move it on. There's always been shuffling. But I think the point remains, and I made this point to the Berkeley side recently, that this area has always been a haven for the unhoused. Whether it was visibly here with tents and structures, or if it was just put on the periphery. You know, someone sleeping on sleeping bags on the next to the sidewalk where it turns into BP jurisdiction. There was even once when BPD and UCPD worked together, and so UCPD would come and they would kick the people that had tents on the far side of the park. There's always been like a line of tents. They'd kick those tents to the curb, you know, be like, you got to move, this is our jurisdiction, and then BPD was there to kick them out again. So it was like, you know,
good exercise,
a great exercise in learning how to pack your shit up quick. And so that only happened, I think, once or twice. I think they realized the morals of that, might not play well with most people. And so luckily they didn't do that. But I mean, it's a very valid point. You know, people are upset that there's tents here and that it's been a homeless encampment. But it has always been a haven for the unhoused, always, since I've been here.
In the last year, has that, let's say, between January of last year and the present time, has there been a change in how the park looks?
Well, yes, the tents, you know, altered the kind of fabric of the park. You know, there's been more, the word that people use, I don't really like it, is territorialism. You know, well, because people are now erecting tents, you know, that tent is theirs, therefore the space outside is theirs, or there's been some of those kind of issues that arose just naturally with people, you know, erecting their own personal property in a public space.
Had I not ever been on the ground? You're way ahead of me. Do you have about Santa Cruz?
Oh, I love Santa Cruz. I have great memories of hitching to Santa Cruz. There's, I'm remembering, and I haven't been there for a minute, an anarchist coffee shop or something?
Sub Rosa Cafe.
Sub Rosa! I love that cafe. Absolutely.
That's where the group that I work with meets every week. We're a minuscule group, but still, this is us. We meet in the Sub Rosa.
Oh, cool.
Every Thursday.
Oh, I love the name. HUF. Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. That is beautiful.
Mostly house people are members of this group.
Yeah, mostly house people?
Mostly house people.
Well, it happens. We're all getting housed. You know, that's one of the benefits of this homeless encampment, though, is that the university hired a dedicated social worker and whose name is Ari, and that individual has done an incredible job at housing folks. I mean, he works a lot with some of the more problematic people, which I think he should, and they should probably be housed first. You know, the elders, the people that are, you know, have mental difficulties, all those people, you know, need to get housing. And he's doing a fabulous job. But, you know, a lot of us, I've been unhoused for most of my life. The only time I spent housed was when I went to UC Berkeley. And now I'm on the lottery. I'm on the waiting list. I won the lottery.
You're on the waiting list.
I'm on the waiting list for the Oakland Housing Authority. Now, I have no idea what that means or what time. But most people like to tell me that it's within a year I should have a house. So I will soon to be one of those, you know, select few.
Well, one of the concerns that was brought up by, you may know Carol Denny.
I do know Carol Denny.
Yeah, she and I interviewed her the other day and played her on Free Radio, which you can find, by the way, if you go to the opposite side of that card I gave you. That's where it actually goes out, and also it can be found archived.
Oh, lovely.
On the HUF website.
I'll definitely look it up.
But we talked about Laura's Law, which you may or may not be familiar with. It's the law that strips the people who are facing forced incarceration and forced drugging with even easier forced incarceration and forced drugging at the whim of the police, psychiatrists, family members.
Yeah, yeah.
And it has to do with, it's called Laura's Law because a woman named Laura was killed by someone who was mentally ill, supposedly, and therefore this means that they're all crazy and they have to be, you know, restrained, they should all be locked up and so forth. Yeah. Or at least, you know, they don't recognize the depth of their own illnesses, and therefore they have what's called anagnosia, which is a fantasy word by people who are fans of medicated therapy,
okay,
and that require forced medication by court order. And so we have what's called assisted outpatient therapy, which they mean involuntary outpatient therapy. I'm wondering, have you seen much of that happening in Berkeley or here?
You know, it really depends. I mean, we do have forced incarceration. You know, people do get a 5150 and are sent to John George. But, you know, case in point, that individual that I was talking about that came in the kitchen in a psychosis and was throwing things around and got the 7-day exclusion from the cops. I was speaking to the cops, you know, because I felt, I hate to say it, that in this instance, you know, maybe not a forced incarceration, maybe we shouldn't use that word in this sense, but some type of forced respite was needed, you know, instead of kicking the person to the curb and letting someone else have to deal with that psychosis down the road, which undoubtedly they would, you know, that person desperately needed some type of release, of some catharsis. And I think that's a real conversation we need to start having, is that there are people that require at least a caregiver or someone there that...
Is that frequent here in the camp.
No, and it's not. I should have got to my point quicker. The cop was mentioning like the criteria for like forced incarceration, and it is so extreme that even some of the more extreme members of our community, I'm thinking of like Gina, for instance, who's been here, who's like a primordial being, has always been in Berkeley. One of those people that's constantly talking to themselves and throwing things at people, and is in almost a permanent psychosis. They won't even put her in. And I think there comes a point when we have to ask ourselves as a community, is it all right to just allow people to, devolve, essentially? Gina's drug use is only enabling her mental illness. And so at some point, and I spoke to the people that came for the alternate group in Berkeley, they interviewed me, and I made it very clear, we need to have some method of forced respiting or forced something. We need to give some people better care than they're giving, because they cannot care for themselves. If you're in a permanent psychosis because you're doing a lot of drugs and you can't get off it for whatever traumatic reasons, for whatever, childhood responses they are, the fact of the matter remains that these people need help.
So you express a lot of concern about this, yet you are also saying that this is not terribly frequent in this case.
No, and that's, I think, one of the greatest issues, is that we have... And I hope people don't get offended that I'm using psychosis so willingly as a descriptor. But we have a lot of people that are going through some sort of psychosis in this community almost daily. I see it in the kitchen. And I have to, work with word salads to try to figure out what people need. Usually I just, hold up a water bottle or Coke. And they'll grab it. They know what they want.
And what... you're going to get right now is a little more music, but we'll be coming back to this.
We're canceling flights, we're stopping the mail, we're hot to trot on the terrorist trail. Can you tell me how to get to Sesame Street? Bert's been bad and he can't be part, hanging around Osama bin Laden, that evil Muppet master of deceit. But we'll hammer Osama by battering Bert with the Patriot Act. They're both gonna get hurt. We'll teach them a tedious lesson by arresting Ernie. 'Cause being best buddies a criminal sin. If your friend might offend and you don't turn him in, and if you are a friend of Ernie, I'd see an attorney. Sunny day. Just a precaution, that ounce of prevention. They're all non-citizens. Christ, they're barely human. Big Bird's been booked for a stretch in the box. Elmo gets tickled till the little guy talks. Got 3 G-men grilling Grover. Boys, business is booming. This piggy won't talk, so she's strapped to a gurney. She's got her cell phone and she's dialing up Kirby, but nobody answers. The line goes click, click, click. You see, most of the phones here on Sesame Street are all wired by the Patriot fleet. And now there's 13 bugs at the Ladybug picnic. And it's a sunny day. Everything. FBI goon will be marching him off to
a secret tribunal where it's three against one for the hot seat with no appeal. And since PBS has been harboring terror, we're cutting the funds for the News with Jim Lehrer. Trying to find Mr. Rogers? Check the Bastille. We're making a list of each girl and each boy with a sesame book or a sesame toy. This program's brought to you by the letters C-I-A. And don't ask about Kermit. He just disappeared. You see, he was the kingpin, a fraud to be feared. We're compiling a list of his fans now. Have a nice day. Have a sunny day. Everything's a-okay. Somebody's learning his lesson on Sesame Street. Oh, it's a sunny day. Everything's a-okay. Somebody's learning his lesson on Sesame Street.
And that, in case you missed it, was Terror on Sesame Street, of course, from the Puppet Town album by Charlie King and Karen Brandow. Now back to Berkeley People's Park with Chef Nick and probably a few others chiming in.
And so, no, it doesn't happen. It shouldn't happen the way it is. Like, I don't think people being sent to John George and being forced to take medication is a good thing. So,
is it happening frequently?
No, it is not, to answer your question quickly. And I'm kind of glad it's not. But that's not to say that there shouldn't be some method in the future that we can, you know, imagine as a society to help these most vulnerable people amongst us. Because they need help. And just letting them, you know, I'm just going to be frank, die on the street is not a viable way forward for anyone, and not a viable way for a society that pretends to, you know, care for, you know, the most marginalized amongst us.
Has there been much attack on activist leaders in the homeless community, in as much as there are activist leaders?
That's a funny question. There is a lot of internal strife right now between activist members. I feel like a lot of people, well, obviously, we all have ego, and it gets in the way.
Except
but,
me.
Oh, yeah, but of course, you have the big beard. That exempts you.
Exactly.
Naturally. No, I mean, like, the kitchen's a perfect example. Thank you so much, Christina. You are awesome. That just to aggregate, is a mother. She lives, she has two different children she comes with and shows them the community. She also does my dishes and brings baked goods. And she just lives two blocks somewhere.
Do you have a personal relationship with this woman?
She's married, but...
Do you have an adulterous personal relationship with this
woman? I have a platonic relationship with this amazing...
You study
being.
Socrates together.
No, I mean, she just manifested, honestly. She came here and just started helping, and it's been a regular, and it's people, and I get that a lot. I get so many people in the community to just come by, and they see the artwork, and they are just inspired. But at the same time, like you mentioned attacks on activists, I have a lot of people attacking me, attacking the kitchen, attacking the work I do, attacking just
verbal attacks, or they come with attacks.
Well, no, no one's cut. No, I know security. Remember, so no one will come here with axes, but attacking. Like, I got the kitchen passed in the People's Park Committee unanimously. The next week, I had all the elders trying to destroy it and saying I had to uproot the kitchen. And since that, basically,
except
I built...
For me.
Except for... But you're not part of the online committee. You're the real people, you know, in People's Park Resistance.
You're referring to the evil Elizabeth?
No, not the evil Elizabeth. Elizabeth brings me food and support and dishes, and it helps me kind of vent when I'm having to deal with a lot of stupid online bullshit, which I've had to because of this kitchen.
I'm water, remember? He's kitchen. I'm water. I'm the water tank, he's the kitchen.
So we have earth, air, kitchen, and water.
No, we almost have Captain Planet. I think we're missing. We need love right now. There's a lot of love missing in this activist community.
The fifth element.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I don't know where. I think a lot of it stems from ideological differences, because a lot of activists tend to be, and I don't mean this offensively, but on the fringe of some sort. They're not necessarily people that hold ideologies that are very inclusive. And I think a lot of the strife comes down to just ideological differences.
An example would be
Andrea Pritchett, who is on Cop Watch, absolutely despises structures in this park, thinks they shouldn't be here, thinks the kitchen shouldn't be here, and has an almost naive view of like non-violence as a form of protest.
Dogmatic nonviolence.
Dogmatic. You know, at some point we need to be able to say that we can exclude certain people from our own personal sphere if they're not healthy for us. I think we have the right to say that, but Andrea does not believe that. And so that'd be like a perfect example. Mike Delacour, who's another OG, was here when the park was first founded and has been here ever since. You know, he's attacked the kitchen a lot. Mostly
issues.
And he's attacked the kitchen for you know, serving meat and having barbecues. I have food, not bombs. I'm just giving you all the examples. I always have examples. No one can say I don't have examples. Food, not bombs, constantly complains about, and I quote, the obnoxious smell of meat that wafts from my kitchen.
How do the people in the park like the kitchen?
Oh, they love it. They love it. I had tri-tip and pulled pork sandwiches the other day, you know. With stuff,
J.C. Orton and the he's with the Catholic workers.
You know, I don't work with him specifically, but I respect the work he does. He's been around a lot. I think he would be totally down with it. The meals that he serves often have a meat component. You know, a lot of people in this park are, you know, omnivores at the very least, if not just mostly a carnivore. Food Not Bombs does not do it for us, frankly. And if you look at the demographics of Food Not Bombs, you actually observe it. Most of the people that eat it don't even stay in the park. They come here for Food Not Bombs and then they leave. And then there's a lot of waste that ends up feeding the rats.
How often does Food Not Bombs serve?
They, I'll give them credit, they come 7 days a week.
And it's what is their schedule like?
They come around 3 to 3:30 every day, and it's basically the same thing every single time. Rice, beans, some type of vegetable, some type of fruit.
No chocolate?
No. Well, some are better than others. The Monday crew really does it justice. They have like someone that makes a lot of home potatoes, and they have popcorn, and they have a giant thing of tea that they bring themselves. They really do a lot of quality. There's a lot of quality to their work.
When I asked you about activists, I'm interested in inter-activist strife, because I get a lot of shit myself. For example, there's a group called the Santa Cruz Union of the Homeless, which is Anthony Prince, the attorney, has been responsible for, in large part, for injunctions in at least four different cities.
Oh, wow.
Defending the park, the homeless in the park in Santa Cruz, in San Lorenzo Park, in Sausalito, the Anchor Outs, if you're familiar with them, Sacramento, although that injunction isn't going so well, and I guess there's another one. I don't know. I don't think he was involved in Emeryville, and he certainly was involved with the Caltrans thing. But there's a fourth one. But some of the I've been told I'm excluded, for example, from this organization.
Are you included in this meeting?
For those who want Nick to contact you or learn more about information about the park, Have you got a website? Have you got a...
No, but yeah, I try to stay away from the internet.
You know, stock holdings we could look into?
Yeah, I have a whole stock profile. You can you can email me. My email is nicholas.alexander@berkeley.edu, and that's Nicholas with a C-H. Feel free to email me. I'd be interested to hear from others.
We'll put you on the Huff email list.
Oh, please do, yeah, absolutely.
Do you like my email?
Yeah, definitely. Maybe you can give it to...
It'll be interesting to hear this. And have you ever had... Do you have live broadcasts, or is it all pre-recorded?
It's all pre-recorded, pretty much. But it's archived, so you can listen to it at any time.
That's cool. All right, cool. Thank you. You messaged me? Yeah, I don't have my phone on me right now. All right, see you later, Katie. Nice seeing you.
And you just had a... This is part of an organization you're working with?
Yeah, well, it was, actually. There was a lot that happened today. The People's Park Committee kind of merged with Defend People's Park. Defend People's Park was a group formed by a lot of the students and other activists that came to take down the fences when the drills were here. And I think that's a good thing. You know, I don't think we needed two groups, you know, representing People's Park. I think one group is sufficient. We're also combining our financial resources as well, our ability to fundraise. And so I think that today was actually kind of, really significant in that regard, because I feel like that's it's only going to get better now, hopefully.
Now, do these groups have a website that people can reach for, updates that can go to quickly?
Absolutely. So People's Park Committee /Defend People's Park have a link tree that is, you can find real easily by going to...
I'll just spell it out. LINKTR period EE / People's Park, I think.
It could be.
It could.
Give it a try, folks. See what happens.
Maybe. But, I mean, we have information. People's Park Committee has a website. We're probably going to be updating things soon, hopefully.
That was correct.
We also have an Instagram,
People's Park Berkeley on Instagram.
People's Park Berkeley. Yeah. So we have the whole kit and caboodle.
Or you can come to People's Park and talk to people.
Yeah, that's my preference.
Set up a tent. Now, if somebody comes to try to set up a tent, is there a committee that comes and standards that they...
You just have to be kind of judicious about where you set up a tent. You know, people, like I said, are erecting their own personal property in this space, and so they are a little protective of it to a stranger that maybe you want to just set up right next to them. So just be judicious about...
Much theft in the park between people?
Not between people. I'll use the kitchen as a perfect example. We've had zero theft. We have a lithium battery there. Oh, should I put all this on?
Come and get it, folks.
We have an entire solar array, 4 250-watt, 36-volt panels, a lithium battery, an inverter, MPPT charge controller. We have tons of food. We have a $300 oven. We have two different grills. We have so much in there that people could steal, and we haven't had one theft.
What about among individual tents? Is there much theft?
No, not amongst this community. And a lot of times, I love giving you examples. Just the other night, a problematic member of our community took the wallet of another member of the community, and when we found that out, we immediately first canceled the person's card so the person couldn't use it, and then found the wallet. So that's really key. You know, we have a really strong community here, and we really do look out for each other. You know, we understand that, you know, we are, you know, not the dregs of, but we're overlooked. I've always been overlooked as a foster youth, so I know what that feels like. The fact that we only have each other really kind of motivates us to look after each other.
We are Berkeley people, but anyway.
I mean, I would trust people in this park more than I trust almost anyone outside of it.
How many people would you say are in the park now, living here on a permanent basis?
At least 50.
And how would that compare with, let's say, 6 months ago?
It's an increase. Not everyone was willing to go through the motions of, like, moving their tent across the street to BPD property, then moving it back.
That was required 6 months ago. In the middle of the COVID epidemic.
In the middle of the COVID, but they also, you know, they're weird. Sometimes they enforce the laws, sometimes they don't. I remember when I first went homeless again after my eviction, I was sleeping in the park itself, right over there under a tree. I remember getting woken up by
the Haston area near Haston Telegraph.
And I remember being woken up by a police officer and my dog, and he woke me up before they got near me. And the police literally apologized for waking me up and moved on. And this was like at 1 in the morning. I mean, granted, they were probably looking for someone, and I wasn't the person they were looking for.
Did they know who you were? Did you know them?
Oh, that's a funny story. Perhaps. I was a street kid on the streets of Berkeley before I was a UC Berkeley student. And so one of the jokes I have is that I actually have a file with UCPD. They knew me when I was a street kid, and then they got to know me as a UC Berkeley student.
Are you an informant for the BPD?
I might have informants in the BPD.
Very interesting.
But no, they do know me. You know, they are very well aware of me. I had a cop actually, in fact, harass me with my dog and try to get me a ticket for my dog just because I challenged him about harassing my friend that was leaning on a store. He said it was trespassing. I'm like, no DA is going to prosecute that. Shut the fuck up. No one wants to hear this bullshit. And then he decided to harass me and give me a ticket because I didn't have a rabies vaccine visible on my dog. And I think one of the sergeants ended up finding me and apologizing for his officer.
How much time did you have to take out of what you were doing to deal with the ticket?
Nothing. I didn't deal with it at all. I didn't pay it. I didn't care to pay it. It was one of the tickets that doesn't turn into a bench warrant. And so I'm like, you can go fuck yourself. I don't care.
How many people would you say have gotten citations in the park in the course of the COVID?
None. I mean, that I've been wanting to do a public records request at UCPD to find out, to show, like, how many citations were in the park, like, in 2011 compared to now. I mean, the drop in the number of citations would be so significant, it'd be jaw-dropping.
What about the crime rate here in the park?
Well, it's none, because there's no more arrests in the park, so I don't know how we have crime in a park.
We're redefining crime as occupancy?
Well, they've always defined it as that. I mean, that's how the facilities manager comes to me on Tuesday. He points at that rule sign right above the kitchen, which I need to tear down. I keep forgetting to tear it down. I'll be tearing it down soon.
Vandalism is being discussed here. Conspiracy to engage in vandalism.
Yeah. No, I was just speaking hypothetically.
Of course, hypothetical.
All this is hypothetical.
Go ahead, Elizabeth. So I'm Elizabeth, and I'm part of Occupy Berkeley, one of the original people. He's also Occupy Berkeley.
Fair enough. So,
with his kitchen, did you dig
up? Yeah, I already spoke about my kitchen, Occupy Berkeley. It was a lovely kitchen, but honestly, this is the best kitchen I've ever built in my life. I built a few kitchens. I was really, and it was cheap. You know, I just found pallets and wood in the industrial sector that was given out free. $100, and I built the first section. Then $200, I built the second section.
Now, are you training a second in command, so to speak?
I wish.
Also, we might add that months ago, the park was originally fenced in, and the students took the fencing down, carried it all the way up Telegraph Avenue, and put it on the steps of the admin building.
Three times, I understand.
Yeah, and that was awesome. So what we have is certain personalities who do not like structures in the park because UC doesn't want structures. So there's some sort of clash there.
Dig it.
Yeah.
Well,
we're all into the kitchen. Because it's a community.
And the point that I care about is, does the direct community want this? And the direct community does.
How are the neighbors about all this?
And neighbors are actually quite stunned. I know a lot of them. Like I said, I've been here forever. I used to hang out at Willard a lot. I know a lot of the dog people there, okay. And a lot of the Housy people. And they're stoked about this. They're happy that a structure like this has been, you know, built and that it's bringing people together.
Food. They bring a lot. They donate pallets of food.
There any what? Yeah, that's a negatorial. No tape. Sorry. And so, I think that the community is going to, the Berkeley side, our community paper just recently interviewed me. I'm not sure when that article is going to be out. Generally, people are down with the idea. And ultimately, like I keep telling people, you know, this place has always been a haven for the unhoused. And with that comes a necessary food insecurity. So, I mean, if we're going to just speak ethically, this kitchen should have been here from the very beginning.
Above and beyond the kitchen, I'm talking about the whole community in the park. How does the neighborhood regard the community? Ooh. Are they going to be out to defend this when the police arrive to remove it? Or will they be sitting saying, gee, ain't it a shame? What do you think is
well, you know, what do you define as community in this sense? Do you define only Berkeley residents or do you define the Bay Area as the community? Okay. I'm going to define it as the Bay Area. And that's why, honestly, I've never really been that worried about the park because I've been in so many protests here. You know, the 2014 Black Lives Matter protests where we took over I-80 and walked down to Emeryville, you know, the Milo riots. I see how the Bay functions, and I also know the UC doesn't have infinite resources. I know the moment they put a fence around this, that anarchists around the Bay Area are going to flock here to cause a ruckus.
How would that suit the people who live in the park?
Well, it will suit the park at that point. The people living in the park will have already been ejected, and at that point, we're going to have to make sacrifices to save the park. But, you know, I brought up the Milo riots for a good reason. It cost UC Berkeley.
Tell people what the Milo riots are.
Milo Yiannopoulos, a nobody that no one really needs to talk about anymore, came to the university as kind of a publicity stunt.
He's a right-wing ideologue?
Exactly a right-wing ideologue. And because of that, and because of the tenor of this university being necessarily liberal, there was a lot of planned protest, and so the UCPD had to, you know, there was a protest that night. We had a lot of people. We surrounded the building. We stopped Milo from speaking. They had to ferret him under the tunnels somehow and get him on his way. We literally took over the university for at least 2 to 3 hours. That cost the university $800,000.
In what way?
Security costs, overtime pay, for the officers, for the time, for the materials, the barriers they built, the officers,
You're looking into the
phone. There was just a, is that the guy that always has the foil? There's the ad, is the foil man. That gentleman, for some reason, always walks around with a piece of foil with meth on it. And he never takes, I've seen him on a bike. I call him the foil man. I don't know. You can almost see the foil on, I think that's in his hand. I don't really understand. I had to chase him out of Willard once. Willard is a park 2 blocks down. It's kind of a family-friendly park. There's a playground there. He sat, like, I think it was 10 feet away from these mothers with their babies and just took a big hit of meth. I'm like, you need to kick rocks, friend, because this is not the place you're going to be doing that. Oh, I got distracted. Sorry. And I was mentioning
Milo.
Milo, yes, the $800,000. And so, ultimately, I feel like the moment they put a fence around this, the cost is going to be so prohibitive that they're just going to give up. Because it's not going to stop. And, I mean, just think tactically how you would have to defend this park from incursions. Well, you're going to need a fence up. But fences aren't completely stable. We've shown that with the fences that they put up for the drilling. Those were torn down 3 times. So the only way to keep the fences up is to have security there at all times, at least within visible distance of each other, so that, like, one section of the tent that doesn't have a security doesn't just come down real quickly. Well, that costs a lot of money. Add to that there's going to be crowds.
Joe Biden can supply that funding.
Well, you know, Joe Biden isn't Reagan, so hopefully Joe Biden wouldn't. And
Didn't Clinton supply money to defend? I don't know whether it was the volleyball courts or the 92 through 96. I know there was Bush before that, but. What I'm saying is police are much better funded now than they have been in the past.
Perhaps, but we also defund the police is becoming more of a talking point.
It's a talking point, but it is not an acting point.
Well, that's not necessarily
except
true.
Except in Oakland to some small extent.
In Berkeley, it will be a true point soon. I think that if it starts costing the taxpayers millions and millions and millions of dollars to keep a fence up here, I just don't see a viable way for them to keep it up. I think eventually Carol Kreis is going to throw up her hands.
She's the chancellor.
She is the chancellor right now. And say, I'm done with it. I can't do it. We can't do it. We don't have the funds to do it. Oh, wow. I see Ivar with Aiden. Wow.
Wait a minute.
Wow. Another Aiden ass licker. You can put that on the radio. That is hilarious.
Clarify, please.
Oh, I got to clarify. So there's an individual in the community. Their name is Aiden. They're trans. We don't get along. We have an inherent dislike for one another. I've seen that person cause trouble for people that I consider family. So I especially don't like that person. But I also don't engage them at all. I just keep them out of my sphere, and you know, we're fine. More recently, because of the activism of the kitchen and the fact I've had to be more integrated with other groups to get funding and so forth, I've had to deal with that individual. And they're just bullshit. And I think it is so telling that Ivar, I'm going into internal politics. No one wants to hear this bullshit.
Does this have anything to do with this vehicle?
No, I think that's just food, not bombs.
Near the stage as we look.
Yeah. That is great. Oh.
What?
Oh, Ivar's over there with Aiden and his boyfriend.
I think this is something else.
No, I know, but Aiden and his boyfriend are down there, and Ivar, I always said he was an Aiden ass licker, and I was right.
Literally.
Oh.
And we will get back to this at another time, but we've been talking with
Nick. Yeah, it's Nick.
Thank you, Nick. And again,
you're welcome.
Again, you've mentioned it several times throughout, or somebody has. But if people want more info, they can reach you at
nicholas.alexander@berkeley.edu, or you could just look up the People's Park Berkeley, and then we have a website. We have a link tree that June shared with y'all. There's ways of getting in contact with the group, but if you need to get in contact with me as an individual, nicholas.alexander@berkeley.edu is where to go.
And you have my card.
I do.
So, who says we don't have a boisterous, uncensored, unashamed, unnecessary conclusions to some interviews? It's what it was. And if you have questions about Nick, you can always get in touch. And you can also find out what's going on in Berkeley by going to some of the sources he's suggested. That's almost it for this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadside. So let's take a musical break, and I will see if I can cram anything else in or whether I shall just gracefully bow my way out.
America loves to flex its muscles.
Now we reach our finest hour.
We're the only superpower.
What good are those treaties doing ya?
Now that we're the big kahuna,
they can keep their solemn pledges.
We don't need no stinking badges. We don't need no stinking badges.
They want a treaty to declare a ban on using germ warfare.
Over 6 years in the making, international undertaking.
Hey, that would require inspectors sniffing round our private sector.
Go inspect what Sodom hatches. We don't need no stinking badges.
We don't need no stinking badges.
U.S. sponsored sanctions threaten trade and automatic weapons.
Peace is just a subterfuge. Arms are small, but sales are huge.
We stand up for everyone's religious right to carry guns.
Real men don't use safety latches. We don't need no stinking badges. We don't need no stinking badges.
Anti-ballistic missile treaty
stamps out jobs, starves the needy.
Nuclear non-proliferation.
That's okay for Danes and Haitians.
We can win the weapons race.
We can rule from outer space.
Invasion of the body snatchers. We don't need no stinking badges.
All the bleeding hearts are swarming.
Hear them storming. Global warming.
Warm is good.
Future shining. The problem is their global whining.
They signed a treaty in Kyoto.
Luddite lemmings, doomsday dodos.
We know who the ruling class is.
How you like our greenhouse gases?
We don't need no stinking badges. We don't need no stinking badges.
And that was another good one from Puppet Town, Charlie King and Karen Brandow. We don't need no stinking badges. And here's a story in, May 27th Chronicle. Oakland tenants file class action suit by Sarah Ravani. Dozens of tenants in Oakland filed a class action lawsuit and four multi-plaintiff lawsuits late Tuesday against Mosser Capital, the San Francisco real estate investment company, alleging illegal utility gouging and harassment, attorneys said. The allegations include driving up existing rents by imposing new utility fees, unlawful entry into units, refusal to make repairs, and charging tenants for necessary repairs. The lawsuit filed in Alameda County Superior Court demands a jury trial, unspecified damages, and asks a judge to prohibit Mosser and other companies named in the lawsuit from pressuring tenants to vacate their units. It would also require the defendants to refund all utility fees, make necessary repairs, and prevents them from entering units for unnecessary reasons, according to the lawsuit. We are seeing obviously an increase in speculators buying property in rent-controlled jurisdictions with a specific goal of basically making money by pushing tenants out and using lots of different illegal practices, said Leah Simon Weisberg, the director of Alliance of Californians for Community Empowerment, a community organization that supports economic, racial, and social justice, which is filing the suit. The tenants, who are members of the alliance, live in four Mosser Capital buildings, but the class action lawsuit covers all 22 Mosser Capital-owned buildings in Oakland, Simon Weisberg said. Mosser is a major owner of San Francisco Apartments and acquired several Oakland buildings starting in 2016. A spokesperson for Mosser said it has not been served with a lawsuit. The spokesperson said in a statement to the Chronicle that Mosser is, quote, committed to maintaining and improving properties so residents have a quality place to call home. The company said it is maintenance and management staff that live and work at 425 East 18th Street, one of the properties in the lawsuit in Oakland, and are, quote, deeply committed to the community. Since taking ownership, the company states it has made improvements, including the electrical systems, painting common areas, installing new carpets, and providing new mailboxes. The company also stated it is, quote, actively supporting residents under financial duress as a result of the COVID economic crisis so they can benefit from our government's program to relieve their stress of carrying this debt. The defendants, including Mosser and others involved with its properties, landlord affiliates of Texas-based Invesco Advisors, Inc., a property management company, FPI Management, Inc., and Yes Energy Management, Inc., Conservice, LLC, and Deposit IQ and Renters IQ Insurance Agency, LLC. The lawsuit comes 10 months after tenants at a different property owned by Mosser Capital protested when the company planned apartment showings for investors during the pandemic and eventually sold the building. Simon Weisberg said Mosser Capital is an example of a speculator landlord which purchases buildings in hopes of reselling quickly and turning a profit. It's not about providing people with shelter, she said. It's just a business investment that has nothing to do with what it's actually intended for.
Tenants at several of the properties complained of unfair practices from the company and its management staff that resulted in stress during the pandemic. Jamila Bojima, a resident of the 421 East 18th Street for nearly 11 years, said when she moved into her studio unit, her landlord covered utilities, water, and garbage. But that changed several years later after Mosser Capital acquired the property in 2016. Last June, in the midst of the pandemic, Bujina and her husband were told that they had to start covering utilities. If they didn't, Mosser imposed a $25 late fee per month, Bujima said. Oakland law prohibits landlords from unilaterally shifting utility costs to tenants, the lawsuit said. Prior to the pandemic, Bujima worked as a preschool teacher in Berkeley, but lost her job when the schools shut down. Her husband works as an Uber driver, but stopped driving for several months in fear of contracting the virus. The extra charges were concerning, she said. It is unexpected, Bujima said, with the pandemic and everything. It's just stressful. Saeed Kulagli, 39, a resident at 421 East 18th Street, said he feels the extra fees are the company's attempt to push him and his wife out. Both he and Bujima pay $865 per month. He is trying to push us through the door because they want to bring in new tenants that he will charge maybe double or triple the amount we are paying now, Kulagli said. And that's Oakland Tenants Sue San Francisco Real Estate. Oakland Tenants file class action suit by Sarah Ravani in the May 27th San Francisco Chronicle. And that kind of brings us to the edge of the show. So let's go out on yet another number from King and Brandow and their album Puppet Town.
Appalling, the villains are winning, the heroes are falling. When all of your life needs a good overhauling, when the end of the tunnel is dark, you gotta take the hard facts from wherever you look. You gotta boil them soft in your pressure cooker. Sometimes you're so sad, you gotta try happy. Pour yourself out in love. You go out with a frown. You find trouble waiting, your worrisome busyness, a workshop of Satan. This world is a sweatshop, needs recreating, but we're all working overtime. I invite you to take an unscheduled vacation, participate in a life transformation. Sometimes you feel you must dance to survive, pour yourself out in love. Love, 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 my friend. Yourself out in love. Love, 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 my friend. Pour yourself out in love. You say you're looking for love. Why don't you live it? Don't wait around for another to give it. Turn yourself on this melodious pivot and you'll find you're facing the sun. This world doesn't need another go-getter. So be a go-giver, you'll find it much better. I tell you, you get much more than you give when you pour yourself out in love. And then sing love, 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 my friend. Pour yourself out in love. You can sing love, 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 my friend. Pour yourself out in love. Believe this song grew out of sadness, a worrisome downtime of self-serving madness. When I hit bottom, I opted for gladness, not knowing how high I could bounce. Ooh, I had emptied myself out as a worrisome grumbler. So I filled myself up to the brim of the tumbler. Then wrote this song to tip myself over and pour myself out in love. And I sang love, 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 my friend. I poured myself out in love. Now you sing love, 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 my friend. Pour yourself out in love. Pour yourself out without hesitation. Give of yourself without calculation. This very smart world lacks imagination, and we're pouring ourselves to death. I invite you to take an unscheduled vacation, participate in a life transformation. Sometimes you feel you must dance to survive,
pour yourself out in love and then sing.